So could you start by saying your name and what your job title is?
My name is Lizzie Stafford and I'm Clinical Research Nurse Manager with Oxford University and I'm based up at the John Radcliffe Hospital.
Okay, that's great. So going back to how you first got interested in nursing, can you just give me the main sort of milestones in your career so far?
Well, it's rather boring really. I was very clear from a young age that I wanted to go into nursing and I recall my wonderful mum making a little costume as a gift for a friend's birthday party, and I think we were probably seven, and the gift was this homemade nurse's outfit, and she modelled it on me because it would fit me, and I went off to the party and gave it away rather sadly and came home to discover she'd made another one for me. And I think that confirmed it. And yes, from a very young age, without any real understanding of what the profession was about, I had a strong sense that I wanted to be a nurse. And I continued in that pathway. And at the age of 18, I went off to study nursing at university.
Where did you go?
I went to Reading. And then on qualification, moved around quite a bit. I've worked in Bristol and in Exeter and in London and now in Oxford. And I, in the middle of all that, trained as a midwife as well. However, I have come back to nursing, found that there was more in nursing that was suitable for me. So I and found myself very much in acute sort of urgent care, emergency care, intensive care environments all the way through until I got married and we moved to Oxford, and I thought perhaps a bit less shift work and a bit less weekends would be nice. And that's when I started exploring research. And I was originally, I came to Oxford to a post in hepatology, which is the study of liver disease, and was part of a team for over a decade, which started off as me and one colleague and then grew and grew. And we had, you know, one study at the beginning, which grew to a large portfolio of studies into all different liver diseases, and we had commercially sponsored ones, we had academically led ones that were local Oxford studies, and we were by early 2020 a pretty big team with about six or seven nurses and other support staff, running a portfolio of about 25-30 research studies in the JR, the John Radcliffe.
It's a simple question. I hope it's not a silly question. But what does a research nurse do?
No, it's a very good question. And it's one many people ask. So there are different types of role as a research nurse. There is the academic research nurses who are delivering their own research. These are nurses who have their own research question that they want to answer, just like any other medical professional might. And they will follow their own pathway through an academic route to answer that research question. The research nurses that I sit within the camp of are more what we class as clinical delivery research nurses. And this is about the research nurses who enable large research projects to happen. So whether it be big commercial sort of sponsored studies that are global, whether it is even just a small, single site, local, academically led study, if it involves the recruitment of patients and if it involves the management of those patients, you're going to need support staff to do that. And the person, often the researcher behind that research, isn't in a position to actually make that happen. So research delivery nurses very much take on the role of understanding the fullness of the study, and then the responsibility of identifying, recruiting, consenting, and managing the care of participants as they come through those research studies. Sometimes for many, many years, some of the studies can go on for even 7 or 8 years in chronic health conditions. The nurses are in a very privileged position then to build up a very nice rapport. They become much as you might a specialist nurse with if these are chronic conditions that are being managed. You become a bit of an expert in that condition, and you also really build up a strong rapport with that participant or patient. And you've equally got research nurses who are managing emergency care work, people coming into the emergency departments. There might be research going on into certain types of traumatic injuries, or there could be research going on to a stroke or heart disease or heart myocardial infarctions, and all different reasons why we need to understand better treatments and better management, all of which around the country there will be researchers asking questions and then building projects to make sure that we try and understand these conditions better and manage them better. But all of that takes a person behind the scenes who can do it. Because of the large amount of quite often it's the paperwork and the rules and the regulations that uphold all of these research practices are very detailed, they're very thorough, and they are different and not the same as normal clinical practice. It's not possible just to expect the nurses caring for that participant or patient on a ward to carry on the research activity. It's too much and it's too expertise, it's too specialist. So over the last sort of 30 years, the role of the research nurse has grown and grown, and is now a very diverse role. And I'm sure even in my explanation, I have probably made a terrible injustice by not including more of its breadth, and there will be colleagues that go, well, hang on, what about what I do? And it does all come under the remit of research nurse.
So. And do you do that all the time? Excuse me.
Yes.
Or is that, so you don't do there shifts are, of, there of are just some, basic care on the ward?
There are some roles that are what they call hybrid roles, where you might have a nurse who a percentage of her working hours is allocated to the research, and a percentage is allocated to clinical care. And there's lots of examples of excellent practice where that works. It's quite hard to manage because of the shifts. And so the majority of research roles tend to be full-time, or if not full-time, then that's their only role.
Yes.
That's what they do.
Yes, yes.
Because of, I think, just the fact that often it's different line managers, there's different funding streams, it isn't funded out of the hospital budget. So it becomes in itself a slightly separate group, even though we very much are working alongside our NHS colleagues who are in the wards and the departments, sort of, you know, kind of doing the core of the NHS work.
So take me through, I mean, I'm quite happy to expand it a little bit. You mentioned recruitment as one of the roles of the research nurse. So you will be the first person who actually speaks to a patient about...
Quite often. So again, it depends on the nature of the study and whether it's an emergency or urgent care, or whether it's perhaps a long-term chronic health condition. So certainly in the emergency departments or critical care units, you will have certain doctors and certain research nurses who will be tasked with identifying suitable participants or patients, and it just depends kind of who spots them first. But there's often a very short time window to recruit somebody into research, because if it involves particularly a drug that is a comparison to standard of care treatment, then if they've already been started on a pathway of traditional treatment, then they're no longer eligible. So there is a very tight window of opportunity in those scenarios. Where so nurses do have to be on call. The research nurses quite often will work the weekends, carry a bleep, and somebody will say, there's somebody arrived, we think they're suitable. You've also then got the vast majority of research in the hospital probably falls under the remit more of your outpatient and chronic care management. Now that could be, you know, you've got a huge amount of work going on in cancer and haematology. And once somebody comes under the radar and they know about them and a diagnosis, then it's very much the role of the clinical team will say, will flag them to the research team and say, there's somebody we think might be suitable. And then you very much often are, the research nurse is often the first person to approach them, whether that's directly face-to-face in a clinic appointment, whether you call them up at home and have a conversation. And you then would be discussing, often with considerable sensitivity if it's a new diagnosis, what it is that you think is unique about them that might work for this study. You tell them about the study, and you have to be incredibly careful to remain an advocate, because you do not want to be persuading or showing any bias towards the correct answer for them, whether it's to take part in the study or not. And it's really vital that they know that they can ask as many questions as they like and can walk away and say, actually, no, this isn't for me. But at the same time, you obviously are wanting to promote taking part in research. We know that the value of research participation is immense, and it's only because of people volunteering in research that we develop our understanding and can produce more and more amazing medicine and science to manage people's health conditions. So it's a fine balance, and you have to sometimes walk quite firmly in the middle, particularly if there's pressure on recruitment and pressure from whether it be the company that is running the research or whether it's even just the investigator locally who's responsible for it. You know, there is targets and you do have to meet them. So often the role of advocate for the research nurse is crucial in making sure that none of that pressure gets passed on to the patient.
And what are some of the ethical issues that arise in whether or not a patient is willing to go ahead?
Gosh, I mean, there's huge things. I mean, you might have, even just in that conversation at the outset, could be language barriers, there could be comprehension barriers that would prevent them from fully understanding what the risks of participation in research are, which are always very well spelt out. You know, we have strong standards, and the ethics committees that review all clinical research are really, really very careful and very strict about what documentation is produced and how it's produced. But you've got to be able to read that and understand it. So you don't want there to be any misunderstanding at the outset. You also recognise that quite often, particularly in the context of a new diagnosis, people might be very scared, very vulnerable, not necessarily hearing all the information. So you've really got to reassure yourself that they have made an informed consent. And that's the difference between just consent and informed consent and really being confident. But then equally, as I say, it's got to be that they feel that there's a real choice, that they fully understand what the alternative would be, that they don't think that taking part in research is the only treatment, but actually that there is other treatment pathways, and that all of them are equally available to them. Yeah, I mean, that's just the sort of the beginnings, really. And then, of course, it's absolutely paramount that somebody might decide to take part. And just like everything else in perhaps even consumer laws, it's perfectly okay to turn around and say, I've changed my mind. And that people can willingly, having gone through the process of signing a consent form and saying they'll take part in a study and setting up those initial appointments and screening appointments, to turn around and go, actually, no, I think I don't want to do this. And that's okay, and they mustn't feel that there's any pressure on them to do otherwise. So the research nurse holds a very important role in that area, I think, of conducting research, making sure we have time to give them, because quite often the investigators, the doctors who are running the studies, simply do not have the privilege of time. They're incredibly busy. So we need to make sure that we have given time to that patient to ask those questions, to really make them comfortable and at ease. And if actually we have questions that we think need to be discussed with the investigator, then we can encourage them and take them to them and sort of get that addressed. But yes, there is lots of areas where managing ethically, you know, the participation of a patient in a study is very much a priority, and even just the whole idea that each time they attend the appointment, you're gaining their verbal consent that they're still willing to take part. There's no assumed assumptions, and you know that you're always being very transparent with them about what you're doing and why you're doing it, and where this information is stored or going or how it's going to be analysed or used, you know, in just complete transparency. There's certainly, obviously, many years back in the past have been some really poor handling of people's personal data and health data, and we are very careful to avoid that now.
Mm-hmm. So you're typically a study is investigating a new drug or a new intervention of some kind.
Yes, I mean, yeah. it might be to do with, so it could be a new drug, it could be a new device, it could be sort of a scanning or radiology related investigation for detection of things. It can also be non-interventional, as we call it, so it is observational. And that can produce a huge amount of understanding by observing a cohort of people who have a specific disease or comorbidity and watching them over prolonged periods of time to understand better the pathway and to sort of be able to observe patterns, which then can obviously identify research questions.
But that observation might include collecting data through taking bloods or other
absolutely,
kinds of
yes.
samples, yes.
Yes, yes. Absolutely. So it's very much a, they engage in that project and they are willingly giving consent, and often it's data and samples at the same time, repeatedly, and are often followed up for many, many, many years. And actually that you know, those sources of data can be, and sampling can be hugely informative in understanding progression of disease. And identifying why some people progress differently. And then obviously you might go back and you might be looking at the genetics of the individuals involved, or you might be looking at the environment of people involved and all of those things. So there's huge amounts of work that go into those projects as well that are non-interventional.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, I think it's time we got to COVID. Can you remember where you were or what you were doing or how you first heard that there was something a bit worrying going on in China?
I don't know if I can remember a specific time. I do remember certain key things on the news when following the development of the outbreak in Wuhan. I mean, I've always been somebody who follows current affairs closely, so I was definitely very aware of what was going on and I was watching it. At what point I started to sort of realise it's coming our way, I'm not quite clear. I mean, I think probably it was in the February of 2020 when Italy was really struggling. Mm. And I think as soon as we realised what was going on in Italy, then there was a sort of okay expectation of this is not going to be possible to contain. I don't think any of us could have imagined what turned out to be the reality. I certainly wasn't imagining it myself, and I do remember quite vividly when I think I must have heard something on the radio one day, and they were obviously contemplating lockdown, so this would have been in the March, and there was somebody talking about school shutting, and I think I had presumed they might shut for a couple of weeks in the run-up to Easter or something. And I heard this presenter saying about the only way for the school lockdowns to be effective was if they were at least 12 weeks. And I just remember stopping and sort of staring at the radio going, you can't be serious. You can't stop the schools functioning for 12 weeks. What will we do? and just this sort of absolute heavyweight reality check kicking in and going, oh, I haven't thought this through. And so just really sort of, so that was outside of work, obviously, and that was very much sort of recognising the impact on home life. And I do remember a distinct, and I look back and I laugh at myself now thinking, gosh, if it was only just 12 weeks. But I do remember distinctly that feeling of what? Being really surprised and sort of, I think that was a defining moment. And I think work-wise, it's a strange thing, and I'm sure other people you've spoken to have probably described something similar, but there was the early part of 2020 when as it became apparent that we were coming into a strange and unknown time in our lifetimes, there was a strange feeling within life in the hospital of, well, yes, sort of battle readiness, I suppose, and getting ready for this arrival of something that was unknown. And none of us really knew what it was going to do. And from my point of view personally, because I was working in research on liver disease, they quickly made the decision that all research studies would have to stop. It was obvious that, particularly in our case, outpatients coming in was just totally inappropriate. They were starting to really plan ahead and say these things are just not going to be possible. So we quite quickly, in must have been early March, realised that our research activity was being paused and we needed to sort of safely shut it down. And some research had to continue because for some people their research activity is actually their drug treatment and their management. So it was important that those people were provided for. But the majority of our research activity slimmed right down and we kind of got right down to a very small core. And that meant the team of nurses that I was managing were freed up to be redeployed, myself included.
But did the ones who did need to continue, did you have to deliver them their drugs at home?
So yes, we had some provision for delivering drugs at home. We had some drive-by pickups of pharmacy medications, literally kind of making arrangements to meet people in the car parks, so that you could just drop a window down, check who it was you were passing the medication through to, make sure it was the right person, check they were okay, and dropping it through the window. Not many. Mostly we had combination of home delivery setups. And thankfully, it wasn't too many patients who were dependent on that, so that was good. So we had some staff who remained perhaps a day or 2 days a week focused on their research, but then the other days of the week they were deployed to another department. And then we had others who were fully deployed. We had some who were shielding or for personal medical reasons weren't able to be patient facing, so took on different roles. And so everybody started doing different things, but we had to sort of physically shut down. And what literally happened was the space where we saw our participants, our patients, was a day case area that the trust told us was going to be redeployed and used for COVID. So we had to literally empty everything out. So the consulting rooms, the storage cupboards, our lab area where we processed all the blood samples, all of that had to be packed away in boxes and cages and parked away and moved. And so it was a huge amount of work, actually, and it was very stressful. It was very unknown, purely from that perspective. And then we sort of did finally reach a point where all of that was packed away and each of the staff in my team had been allocated their new role. But that was complicated from a management point of view, handing over their management to a new temporary manager, getting them arranged on rosters and etc. And for many of us, it meant really updating our skills because as research nurses, you might be experts at phlebotomy or taking bloods or pretty good at ECGs, but it's might well have been a long time since you were working on the wards. And so for most of us, there were certain skills that needed refreshment. If for me, the biggest challenge was updating myself to use all of the digital software that's now required. So everything is electronically recorded. And I was familiar with certain areas of the electronic records that we used in our work. But there's so much more that is required if you're managing the care of a patient who's an inpatient.
So they have everything on iPads now.
Everything is on computers. Yes, I mean, it's literally complete. They have these mobile computers moving around the wards and everything, your drug delivery, all of your care management, all of your note, every request that's made for them or investigation, etc., it's all held in there. So to find the plan, you need to be able to find it, but to document and report what you've been doing, you need to do all of that digitally. So all of that I needed to get updated on and learn, and various other e-learning requirements. So having sort of packed away everything, alongside that, everybody was busy updating e-learning. And then it was about the middle of March when I was finally on a roster and then redeployed to a ward.
And what kind of ward was that?
Well, I was moved to, we had a setup in Oxford where they tried to keep the Churchill Hospital, as they called it, the clean hospital. In other words, no COVID cases. So our gastroenterology ward at the John Radcliffe had been relocated over there. And I was allocated to work with that because of the link. A lot of hepatology research if our patients were ever inpatients, they came in under the department, the gastroenterology department. So there was already a link there. And so we put that, so I was allocated to go and work there, up at the Churchill, and it was a strange, really strange time, because by this point, you know, the schools had shut and the sun was blazing and we had this surreal lockdown world that no one understood. And at that early point, most people were tolerating very well. And I think I have this, and there was this strange, well, this is what we've been trained for. This is why we came into these professions. And there was a really, I think I can speak for most colleagues, there was a really determined sense of roll your sleeves up, get stuck in. Some colleagues were terrified, but majority just wanted to help and do what they could and be wherever was helpful to be helpful. And there was a really amazing kind of camaraderie and atmosphere. And of course, at the same time, the strangest scenario was that where they had stopped all of the outpatient appointments and where they had stopped people coming into hospital routinely, the only thing coming through the doors was really urgent and emergency care. So we actually sort of saw this drop of workload. So you had an excess of staff because there was no annual leave, there was no study leave, all the research staff had been brought in. And in a place like Oxford, you've got a huge amount of academic staff that are clinical that can be redeployed. So we really were very well staffed overall, and actually with very few patients. And in the early days when there was the COVID patients that were coming in were very much being contained in the intensive care unit or on our specialist John Waring ward. And I do remember in those early days, you know, sort of people asking about what's the daily numbers, and you know, it was just low. And yet that's at the point when we'd all gone into lockdown and none of us knew what was coming. And so there was this sort of strange anticipation in the air, not really knowing where this was going or what was going to happen. But at the same time, with I felt very much like, well, no, this is important. I'm glad I can help. I would hate to actually be stuck at home in a lockdown.
Children have key worker school?
We did. It didn't really work, actually. So my husband, in the end, was furloughed for the first lockdown, partly because, unfortunately, obviously, in the first lockdown, none of the schools were prepared and had no experience of how to manage it. So it was tricky. My youngest was only, gosh, what was he, 5 at the time, and would he just turn 6, maybe? And yes, 3 years ago, he must have just turned 6. And he, therefore, you know, homeschooling that age is really tricky anyway. And then my older daughter would have been in the year 4 at that time. But there was suggested work coming home and lots of it. And yet they weren't doing any of it with the key worker kids in the day. So I was feeling under pressure to then try and complete all this work, but in the evenings, which felt ridiculous with such young children, and yet you'd send them in the day and they just played or coloured in. They didn't do any teaching or work with them at all. They didn't follow what they were sending home for children to do. So it was a bit tricky. And so that was quite stressful and was certainly quite concerning. And that didn't really work, and in the end my husband was furloughed and we kept them home. There was also only, I think, 2 other children who were key workers in the school, so there was literally just these 4 children in, 2 of whom were ours, and I think we just felt like, oh gosh, this is not really very helpful for the school. So we, for the first lockdown, that was not straightforward or particularly easy to juggle. But I had this escape. I could jump on my bike early in the morning and cycle off to do my shift, and leave my husband and children at home to worry about that stuff. And I quite enjoyed being back on the wards. I very much enjoyed it, actually, and sort of going back to my roots in nursing, not having been in that kind of role for over a decade. And I really enjoyed the opportunity to refresh those skills.
And what sort of level were you? Because, I mean, you'd had a fairly management role as a research nurse.
Yes, absolutely. So, no, that was quite strange in the sense of they were obviously very aware of the fact that I was in ordinary world, I was normally managing, but I wouldn't have taken on that position at all. So, no, I was very much sort of considered one of the staff nurses on shift, and I made sure that I wasn't treated in any other way. And actually, the teams I worked with were lovely, many of whom I knew, sort of had worked alongside, and you know, they were all fantastic and patient with me because I had a lot of questions and didn't know where things were, and you know, it was from that point of view, but they were great. So that was all sort of strangely quite nice, and I think all of that management responsibility gone, when you're used to carrying that, it was actually very liberating to just go to work and do a job and come home and not have to feel responsible for a team of people or the delivery of a project or the delivery of a programme. So it was very strange and very surreal, and but all quite refreshing in a funny way. And then within a few weeks of being on that ward, I got a phone call from my line manager to ask me if I'd come back to oversee some research at the... based at the John Radcliffe for COVID, and it wasn't part of the main COVID response task force, which was a huge effort that the Trust put in place, where they took most research nurses from a certain funding stream and put them together to form this incredible task force, which was wonderful, and I do hope you've spoken to people who worked on that. But there was a group of doctors, including Alex Mensah, who you've spoken to, who were recognising an opportunity to capture data and samples from staff who tested positive for COVID, and that we would really value collecting that information. And most of those staff were keen and saying, can you take my blood? Can you do something with it? So a project was hastily assembled, and I was asked if I would come and help deliver on it alongside other people and colleagues. And so by, yes, middle of April 2020, that's what I was doing. Mm. And ironically, I'm still doing that today.
Really?
So what was a temporary measure and a redeployment... as the summer of 2020 progressed and we realised the sheer scale of this pandemic, and obviously by then vaccines were busily being trialled, we had set up this amazing cohort of, we had, I think, about, oh gosh, over 150 staff had donated samples to us repeatedly that had tested positive for COVID. We'd made them aware that we were doing this research project and asked if they would take part once they were well enough to be back at work. And then they would come and see us at regular time points for us to take blood samples from them.
So you didn't take the samples until after they'd recovered?
No, so they would have had a positive swab result done through the staff testing programme, mm-hmm. Which was an incredibly efficient service and really, really well managed. And they... as part of their feedback of the results, we had a process where they also told them about this research and said, if you're interested, would you contact this email address? So we had these people volunteer, and then the idea being we ran clinics 5 days a week in the mornings, and these were people who all worked in the hospital somewhere, Churchill or the John Radcliffe, and we ran clinics on both sites so that they could pretty much nip out from their shift, whatever it was that they were doing, and come for a 15-minute appointment with us where we would just update the data and collect a blood sample from them. And we realised that actually building up this bank of samples and data was a really precious commodity. We were able to use those samples as control samples in the Oxford vaccine studies, so where they were busy trialling their vaccines, they had they were able to take from us equivalent time point samples from people who'd had natural infection as opposed to vaccination protection. And we were able to, you know, sort of match their time points and provide that sampling data, which was really helpful, I think, for them.
So you could look at the antibodies and see how exactly they differed between
absolutely
the two.
Absolutely. Yeah. And we were, the programme that we're involved in is very much looking at your T-cell immune response rather than your antibody response, but we work closely with colleagues who do work very much on the antibody response and other areas of our immune responses. And so we have taken what was this very willing group, some of whom still come and see us regularly now, and kept following them through. And we now have this large project known locally in Oxford as OPTIC, but we are part of a national consortium called PITCH. PITCH stands for Protective Immunity to T Cells in Healthcare Workers from COVID. And the idea is we are alongside collaborators around the country. everybody is working towards the same scientific aims and goals. And there is still funding a little bit going into that. So it continues. And with colleagues around the country, we're still addressing the questions of our immune responses to both vaccinations and the different variants. And again, we remain useful controls because there's lots of research looking at drug therapies for the immunosuppressed or immunocompromised groups who are most vulnerable, obviously, and are often least protected from our vaccines. And so we can provide control samples for that. And so we are also recognising that there's, you know, impacts on other respiratory viruses, the influenzas, and that are also problematic. And the fact that we can really broaden out our research so that we can look at other things as well alongside COVID. COVID is here to stay, and we need to make sure we keep abreast and ahead of it if we can. and although it's lost its, it's not really what anyone wants to talk about anymore, we recognise the need to keep understanding it and making sure that we don't let it get the better of us again, and other viruses like it. So I think what was established as a group of a work package that was established in 2020, and the value of that continues even though it's slightly changed its direction. And so when funding became available for a post in it, I decided to apply and make the transition from my former team into staying in this role, and that's where I am.
And you've not been working on projects that involve taking samples from patients who came into hospital?
A little bit at the beginning. So we did support some of our participants were inpatients, only a handful, mostly because there was so much amazing research going on for them that these patients were already being offered opportunities to take part in at sort of two or three other research studies. And it felt probably unnecessary to add another one into the mix. And when there was so much excellent research going on with patients. So we very much focused on providing, because there was so much research looking at those hospitalised with COVID, whereas we were able to provide the answers about people's immune response to COVID when they were not hospitalised, when they managed it mildly, in a sense, at home. And actually that is the majority of the population.
Yeah.
And of course, the rest of the population was in lockdown and we couldn't do any research on them. So the healthcare workers coming into work with this incredibly valuable resource to understand what a healthy immune response to COVID might look like, and to provide that data. So it was, so very much we sort of, although there was some patient involvement at the beginning, we quickly shifted our focus to be purely healthy volunteers, or in this case, co-workers in a healthcare environment who were willing to participate. And thankfully, I think in our case, all of our recruits were, although at times poorly with COVID, all made good recoveries.
So what have been the, you say the study's still ongoing, but there have been some publications. What have been the main conclusions?
Well, we've had, so there was a very interesting study in the early days, which caught the headlines, because we looked at the differences between the vaccines and we looked at the durations. And I don't know if you recall, but there was a little bit of a outcry when the government decided that rather than having 3 weeks between our doses, we were going to get 12 weeks between our doses. And this came out of the news very quickly. And all of the trials had obviously looked at 3 week intervals in these vaccines. But here we were in the real world being told, no, you're going to have to wait. But because of the way that that was decided and the timing of that decision, there was a, we'd started vaccinating healthcare workers in early to mid December of 2020. The decision came late December. So there was already a several weeks worth of staff who'd been vaccinated, who the trust decided locally in order to manage it, that they would honour people up to the end of December who'd already had a first vaccine would still only get the 3 week interval. And then anybody vaccinated from that point onward would have to wait 12 weeks. So we ended up with these two wonderfully comparable groups to be able to compare then long term what the difference was between their immune responses. And it was, you know, in theory, we were providing the research that supported the government's decision, you could argue. And the government were fortunate that the research went in their favour. And the 12-week interval was shown to be, I mean, there was no question, there was differences, but in fact, our memory responses, our T-cell responses on the longer duration were better. And although the antibody responses with the short duration peaked higher, the sustainability of them was better with the longer duration. So we were able to answer that question that had obviously had to be made for practical reasons and with strong scientific reason to believe it would be effective. We were able to quickly get that evidence together and monitor those people over those sort of next 6 months and see what happened, and that paper was able to support that decision. And we're also very keen, not just in looking at blood samples, we also collect from our participants a little thing that we called a SAM strip, which is a little cotton swab that sits inside your nose for a minute and you just press and hold on your nostril while it just absorbs what's in your nose, because there's obviously big questions about our nasal and mucosal immunity and how much people might be protected from underlying immunity. It might be from other coronaviruses that they've previously had, or it could be having had COVID infection that this then gives them an extra level of immunity to protect them from further reinfection. So we're also collecting those samples. And although we haven't had a huge, there's ongoing work on that at the moment, and there will be, I think we'll see more and more of that, recognising that, you know, we want to look at alternative vaccination methods. Nasal vaccines are very common now in the flu viruses, particularly obviously with children. So I think we'll see more and more work like that. But really, I think what we've also looked at is then the booster regimes, because healthcare workers get boosted or offered a booster vaccine, regardless of their age. Again, we've been able to look at the difference that makes on people's immune responses. So being able to gather that evidence in and have large numbers of people who have received a third and now a fourth booster has been really useful in comparing that to people who haven't. And as I say, healthcare workers are a natural group of people who can do that. And then but lots of people, you know, they, in the sense of our samples get requested to be borrowed by other groups who are doing particular things, whether it be to do with the vaccine, whether it be to do with the variants of concern. There's lots of work going on here in Oxford. Gavin Screeton's lab have worked with us a long time through this and are very keen to borrow samples from us or have samples from us when we have got somebody who we know who's had a certain variant. And what we do now is, now that all the testing has stopped, It's very hard for us to know what variant of COVID people have had, because that's something you detect through processing their PCR swab. So our cohort will have at home a little PCR kit that they have ready should they test positive on LFT, to then do on this on themselves and post back, and for us to get the sequence of the virus off it so that we can match their samples with a virus sequence at some point down the road. And just keeping up that information so that we've got access to current samples is really quite important now when there's so little going on kind of from a nation level. So that's sort of what we're doing.
So how much longer do you think the study will be funded for?
Well, we've just been given some funding to keep it ticking along for another just shy of 2 years. Mm-hmm. That doesn't fund everything. It funds elements of the work. But there's plenty of grant writing going on to get the rest of the money to try and fill the gaps. And I think probably it will now probably become something that expands to be more respiratory viruses than just COVID. Mm-hmm. I think it will broaden slightly to allow it to be other pathogens that healthcare workers are exposed to, particularly those that we get, you know, vaccinated against. But we might want to do studies looking at RSV, which has been particularly problematic this year, but also the other influenzas.
Respiratory syncytial virus. Is that
very
right?
Impressive. Yes. So I think probably what will happen is that we'll become a little bit broader and a bit more diverse, but just really recognising what a valuable cohort of these amazing volunteers who are all busy medics and nurses and administrators and porters, and they're all busily doing their jobs, and through their volunteering we've been able to get really valuable and quite rich data from them and sampling from them that's really proved very useful in understanding and answering important scientific questions. Mm.
And does that include looking at how much people vary in their genetic susceptibility or the degree of their immune response?
Yes, I mean it does. I think it's more about what matters, because we know these huge variances happen. So then it's about matching up with the clinical story. So a lot of what we're doing at the moment now is focusing on people who think they've never had COVID. We obviously all believed that vaccination would mean, you know, great protection and not many people would get COVID. And of course, the inverse of that is true. Most of us get COVID despite vaccination. We don't, thankfully, most of us get poorly enough to require hospitalisation. So the vaccines are working. But we're looking at those people who believe they've never had a COVID infection, not knowingly had it. And you know, whether they're testing or not, they might not have been symptomatic. So they've become a group of real interest to us now. So we've been busy recruiting in people that fall into that category and getting them in for sampling. And then we will follow them up to see what happens, whether they do in fact still get COVID. Some of course already have, because there's high levels of COVID now. We're very much focusing as well on them. And the question is, though, does it matter if they've had COVID and not known about it? Like, how much, because that's an important question to answer, how much transmission is unknown, how much is out there without people having any idea that they've even had it. So if we can sort of get a better sense of that or be part of answering that question, that also helps in sort of, there's very much a sense of future preparedness, future pandemic preparedness, and recognising we've got so much we can learn from the COVID pandemic. So many great collaborations and institution sort of developments have occurred because of it. And having put those really excellent working practices into place, it's important we take that knowledge and we use it to our benefit in the future, because there will be future viruses that are going to cause concern. And some may be on the scale of COVID-19, others may be more remote, probably from the UK, but therefore a geographical region of the world. But the knowledge gained here can be just as useful, and I think we all recognise that Just because the problem may be occurring on the other side of the world doesn't mean it can't become a problem for us. So there's a really amazing sense, I think, that of learning how to work together, how to work remotely together, how to collaborate. So many things changed during COVID on that level that were just really quite liberating. And I think people are keen to try and keep that behaviour and practice where possible, to enable just a really good sort of shared knowledge for the future, so that we can hopefully improve upon and manage more efficiently should it happen again, and be able to really be proud of that work that so many in Oxford and other cities achieved, should it come again.
You obviously love being involved in research. I just wondered if there are any issues that sometimes arise in working with academic researchers who don't have the clinical experience. I mean, particularly, I'm sure the older ones, because I mean, Alex was incredibly complimentary and was very anxious that I should promote or recognise the importance of the role of the research nurse team. But I wonder if perhaps some of the more junior researchers have to be educated, shall we say, about what's involved in...
Well, I think maybe I've been rather fortunate, because I think that I can't say I've ever worked in my years here in Oxford in research, which is now, it must be around 14 years, I've never encountered that. I have worked with, you know, senior medics of different years, in the sense of their age, and they all have their different ways of working, but they've all been very respectful, actually, towards the role of the research nurse. Now, we might be fortunate. I think Oxford is particularly ahead of the game. I think that, you know, there's been a lot of research nursing going on here for a reasonably long time, and I think, therefore, exposure is good. So I don't think, actually, the academic population are particularly unaware of what we do. Certainly, but then equally I recognise I'm really talking about senior clinical researchers who I'm directly working with. So, you know, certainly the clinicians have been fabulous, and I think we've been really fortunate to have such a just a real team spirit. There is not a lot of hierarchy in that environment. Everybody recognises the strengths of each other's roles and the need for each other's roles, and I've been very fortunate to work in teams where that's been very paramount. So I've just been very lucky.
So I'm just going to go a little bit onto how the pandemic impacted on you personally. You've talked a little bit about the homeschooling issues and so on, but how threatened did you feel by the possibility of becoming infected yourself?
It's really strange, and I think I remember talking to a colleague quite early on in the pandemic, as we were all preparing to be redeployed, and I'd been talking to a nurse in the team who was very nervous and very anxious and very scared that day, and in a conversation with one of my seniors later that day, I was sort of recounting the conversation, and she looked at me and she said, "Are you scared?" And I said, "No, I'm not." I said, "I don't know why. I don't think I'm invincible, but I don't feel scared." And I just said, "I don't know why. I just don't." And I just had a sort of, it doesn't feel like this is going to be a threat to me. And I had no reason to believe that, because clearly many amazing healthcare workers who were infected subsequently got very sick, and some of them very sadly died. So it wasn't through anything I had any knowledge of. It was purely just a feeling in my gut that I thought I was going to be okay. And with that, I wasn't overtly worried. Of course, I was worried about people I cared for, you know, elderly parents and vulnerable parents, and recognising their vulnerability, and that was definitely a concern. But for myself directly, no, I didn't. And I think I recognise in hindsight, when we were first sampling our cohort, when they were first returning to work, we had a very different policy at the then in the early days, that they could come back to work after 7 days. We didn't have LFTs. And they could come back to work if they felt well enough and didn't have a temperature after 7 days. Now, in hindsight, and at this point, we weren't even wearing masks. Like, it was before we fully understood the need for mask wearing. And I remember somebody taking her, I was taking bloods off a young nurse one morning, and she said to me, aren't you wearing a mask? And no, because I think at that point the policy was with known COVID participants or patients in the hospital, you obviously wore PPE, but not with each other in common areas and staff rooms and stuff. And I said, and she said, aren't you worried? And she'd just a week ago tested positive. Now, in hindsight, of course, we now think, yes, you probably were still infectious. And the knowledge we have acquired means that I now realise that I was putting myself at risk. But at that point, we didn't have the knowledge. We didn't understand the duration, really, of viral transmission. And we didn't realise how long people were going to test positive for. Those first few weeks, probably, I did encounter some risk, unknowing that I was. And I was obviously fortunate. But no, I didn't ever particularly feel at risk. And I think, you know, I was encountering mostly people who'd had COVID and returned to work and were well, and we very quickly were wearing masks and gloves, obviously, and being a bit more careful about our sort of PPE cautions. And so I didn't feel the need to have, you know, I didn't feel particularly vulnerable. Mm. And so that wasn't too bad. And I think the impact on home was more just the, I could see what a lot of stress it was placing on my husband, and trying to juggle we were in a much smaller house before we were here with no garden. And so juggling an energetic 6-year-old and 9-year-old, and not being really allowed out, and was no fun. And it was really, really tough on him. So I think that was my biggest stress, was sort of concern for their, you know, welfare and mental health in that time. And I think all of us were just very grateful for the long sunny days that bathed that sort of early lockdown period.
And were you able to work fairly normal hours? Or just like the period you talked about where you had to clear
shifts,
everything
exactly.
out?
Exactly. So for a while I was doing shifts, long days. I didn't have to do any nights. So that was different for them, you know, in the sense of I've normally been the more part-time of the two of us. So there was definitely a lot more responsibility on, you know, sort of my husband to provide all things domestic. And he was amazing. You know, he stepped up to the challenge fabulously, but was also still, despite being furloughed from his role, there was still activity that needed to happen. And it was just a lot of responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a bit tricky, but we got through that, and I think everybody quickly found little things to be sort of grateful for or thankful for as that summer unfolded, and the promise of vaccines sat on the horizon, and we all hoped that it would get better. And of course 2021 was a tough year, and actually it wasn't much better. In fact, for many, it was probably worse. And thankfully, I think the thing that was different for us by then was we had moved, because in the middle of, in the summer of 2020, we moved house to a bigger house. So by the time the second lockdown occurred in 2021, not only were we better catered for space-wise, but the schools had developed much more robust home learning setups. So we were much more catered for in providing sort of structure. And it also meant that on the days when our children went in as key worker days, they were actually being taught something of what was in the proposed homework. So it felt like they weren't having quite such a loss of education in that second lockdown, that there was more educational provision for them and support for us as parents trying to educate them. By that point, I'd shifted to this role full-time anyway. So this was my new world was COVID, and that's where it has sort of stayed.
And did you think the fact that you were able to work on something that was important over and beyond what you do all the time, which is important, help to support your well-being through those difficult times?
Oh, it's unbelievable the difference it makes, because I remember cycling home and literally cycling down streets of people bashing saucepans, like, you know, 8 o'clock on a Thursday night or whenever it was, and cycling through, and they had no idea where I'd come from. Like, I was just a cyclist passing by, but I knew why they were doing it, and it was just the most incredible feeling to think these people are really grateful. And it's a sad state that I remember very distinctly, despite always knowing I wanted to go into nursing. I remember my secondary school, which is not in the area, had sort of dismissed me when I said I wanted to go into nursing. It wasn't academic enough for them, and they therefore said, oh, good luck to you, off you go. And there was no support, careers advice or anything. And it sort of gave me the distinct impression at the age of 17 that nurses weren't valued, and nursing certainly wasn't valued. So I think you don't realise you carry that. Now, once you work in a hospital and once you start working in the NHS, you realise that as a group of professionals, each of you values each other very highly. So you get great support from peers and a lot of respect from peers. And you know what each other are doing, and you know what an amazing provision is happening in there. And obviously, patients who encounter that, hopefully they taste and experience that, and they're able to understand it. But there is just this constant sense of the general public doesn't appreciate or understand quite how hard everybody in that place is working as a team with different skill sets to deliver the best care possible for those people. And so being able to suddenly have a sense of now the world is appreciating the value of this and how important this is was definitely a huge morale boost. And of course, that's what's so hard now when you look at the state we're in with nurses having to strike because conditions and pay are so awful and so poor. And if you allow yourself to read, you know, kind of comments, particularly in social media, that can be so derogatory about nursing as a profession, and you just have to just, you can't read it, you can't think about it. It's cruel. But basically, generally, nursing is not a respected profession. But briefly there, for a time in COVID, we were. And that definitely helped. Yeah.
Mm. Mm. And has anything about working through the pandemic changed your attitude or your approach to your work or how you think about your career?
Well, obviously, it's actually changed my job. So I suppose quite profoundly, I'm now doing a different, very different line of work, and that opportunity only arose because of the pandemic. I think it makes you, I was very fortunate, we were very fortunate that we didn't lose anyone close to us because of COVID. We didn't suffer personal loss as a family, and I'm very grateful for that. I loved being part of the sense of providing for the world, in the sense of knowing that in some small, tiny way, the work we were doing was supporting other really important research groups, particularly the Oxford Vaccine Group. And knowing that all of those vaccines that have been delivered and that have saved lives has come from the most incredible collaboration of people, and that in a tiny, tiny, tiny way, I was part of that. That's amazing. You know, that's a real accolade and something I'm deeply proud of. So I think it kind of has helped me. I think I'm keen to stay in the working world I'm in right now, because I do see that there is a real sense of this hasn't just gone away. It's gone quiet. People are less interested. But there might be another one, and if that's in my working lifetime, I would like to think that we can take all our knowledge and experience and I can be part of a response to that again in the future. So yes, I suppose, whereas I probably wouldn't have even thought about it, you know, 3 years ago. So I think in that sense, it's changed it a little bit. Mostly, I think probably I've just made sure that we have more toilet roll in the house because the world went out and bought all the toilet roll and we couldn't buy any. So probably my I've learned a lot about making sure we have a few spare toilet rolls. But no, otherwise, I think it's for me been in many ways a situation that's provided lots of opportunity and I'm very grateful for that. And it's highlighted what Oxford has to offer, both academically and in its healthcare workforce here, and the amazing collaborations that exist between those groups. And I just feel very privileged to have been able to be part of it, really.
Thank you very much.